have an obligation to do everything we can to protect those men and women and take down that risk. That's what President Trump was aiming to do. We understand who the Taliban are. There's no more clear-eyed administration. When I was the director of the CIA, I had young men and women serving in Afghanistan, taking enormous risk to their lives. We're aiming to get this right. We're working to talk with those leaders that can actually deliver on these outcomes. That's what President Trump and I are both focused on, and we're going to keep driving towards that outcome.
Secretary of State Mike Pompeo on CNN yesterday. Afghanistan is bracing for increased violence now after peace talks at Camp David were canceled over the weekend. There's some dispute over how those talks were canceled. The president says he called off the negotiations with the Taliban after an American soldier was killed in a car bombing last week. But the Taliban says they hadn't planned on coming until the U.S. had signed a peace agreement, which both sides had agreed to. The U.S. hasn't signed that agreement yet. It turns out there had been significant disagreement within the Trump administration over whether direct talks with the Taliban was even a good idea. Joining me now is Karen DeYoung, national security reporter for The Washington Post. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Great, thanks. Why are there such differing versions as to why this meeting was canceled?
Well, I think both of those versions are more or less true. I think the president, there were many people around him saying, bad idea, bad idea. They were people who had been opposed to the Afghan negotiations from the start, saying the Taliban can't be trusted. Why are you talking to them? And I think did not like the idea of this meeting. And when the U.S. service member was killed on Thursday, went to him and said, now, you see, you really can't be doing this because even as they're negotiating with us, they have killed a guy. Of course, they'd been killing people all along during the negotiations, as has the United States. At the same time, I think the Taliban, the subject was broached with them. They hadn't said yes or no. One point they raised was, why don't we do this after there's actually a signing of the agreement, which was ready to sign. But it was, their position was sort of evolving, and they hadn't actually said, no, we won't come. They hadn't said they would come.
President Trump announces that these talks are canceled, but no one outside of a small group of people knew that they were happening in the first place, right?
That's correct.
And how long were they being planned?
The planning had started about a week or 10 days ago. This was the president's idea of a way that he could both give a jump start to the talks if one thought they needed it, and also get credit for resolving this situation, at least to the extent that there could be a withdrawal of U.S. troops. You know, the less charitable interpretation is that the president, his eye is firmly on his reelection, and one of his initial campaign promises was to end the war in Afghanistan. This way he could say, you see, I'm doing it. And also that the president, as we've seen with the leader of North Korea, with his outreach proposing talks with the president of Iran, believes that he has a personal ability to make things happen with other senior leaders that perhaps are more difficult at the lower levels.
Didn't he increase troops by 4,000 or so?
That was in 2017. You know, when he came to office, there were about 9,000 troops there because President Obama had reduced them quite significantly. Trump came into office saying he wanted to withdraw all of them. And he was convinced by the Pentagon and other people around him that that was not a good idea, that in fact a relatively modest increase would actually improve the U.S. position or the Afghan government position on the battlefield and would allow them to negotiate from a position of strength. So he actually increased the number. And what's being proposed and what is enshrined in this agreement that now is not going to be signed this week is that that increase, which eventually amounted to about 5,000 troops, will be withdrawn, leaving the same number that was there when President Trump came to office.
So basically going back to square one.
Right. But I do think that, you know, I mean, I think there is a view, and this was certainly the view that John Bolton, the president's national security advisor, was espousing, that you can withdraw around 5,000 troops without really undermining the war effort in Afghanistan. And with that, you can still get credit for doing what you said you were going to do. You know, people are not going to go back. Maybe people in the media and stuff are going to go back and say, hey, wait a minute, you know, these are the ones that he sent there. But I think by and large, the feeling was that for voters, this would be something that complied with the president's promise to withdraw troops from Afghanistan.
What do the Taliban want? Complete withdrawal?
The Taliban have always said that they want complete withdrawal of all foreign forces. Remember, there are also several thousand NATO troops in Afghanistan, and their position has always been that that all of them must leave. I think the U.S. hope was that there could be a kind of residual counterterrorism force that would remain in Afghanistan primarily to fight the Islamic State, and that the argument that it made to the Taliban is that the Taliban doesn't like the Islamic State either, and it's for reasons that are too complicated to explain here, but the Taliban actually fights against the Islamic State, and the case the Americans were making was, look, if we're not fighting against each other, then we can both fight against the Islamic State, who we both want to get rid of.
And how much control does the Taliban have over the country? How much power does it have? How much territory?
They control certainly far more than half of the territory, although not of the population, because the government is still by and large in control of the large population centers. But the Taliban, if you look at a map where, you know, usually they color red the areas of Taliban control, it's by far the majority of the territory in Afghanistan, although, again, not the large urban areas.
So the ultimate goal on the part of the Taliban is to regain control of the country?
They say that they are willing to enter the political process, be a political party, make their case. They hope that in the direct negotiations with the Afghan government, they would be in advance of actually being elected to do things in Afghanistan. They would be given some control over some ministries. They would be included in government deliberations. But all that was to be worked out in the inter-Afghan talks.
And there are elections taking place at the end of the month.
Well, there are presidential elections that are supposed to take place on the 28th. There was a lot of talk that if this deal was signed and negotiations were going to start between the government and the Taliban, that those elections should be postponed, which President Ghani did not want to happen because he's seen as being by far the front runner and would like to capitalize on that quickly. It's now not clear whether those elections will actually take place.
Karen DeYoung, she covers national security for The Washington Post. Thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Well, Congress is back in session today after its long summer recess, and House Democrats are eager to get back to their many, many investigations of President Donald Trump. This week, the House Judiciary Committee is expected to take up impeachment. The committee is voting on a provision that would give it extra investigative powers, powers that were used in the impeachments of previous presidents. It's Monday, so Jessica Levinson is here, law professor at Loyola Law School and our regular Legal Eagle. Hello.
It's House Investigation Monday. How are you?
Good, thanks. Well, this hasn't happened allegedly until Thursday, but they're getting ready. They're getting their ducks in a row. What exactly does the Judiciary Committee want to do?
So if there's one word that indicates to people technical or incremental change, it tends to be the word procedure. And that's what we're talking about here. We're talking about new investigative procedures that the House Judiciary Committee can use in their impeachment kind of quest, journey, investigation. So this is not the House drawing up articles of impeachment. This is something short of it. It's essentially creating more kind of specificity and more transparency to the American public about what exactly the Judiciary Committee is going to try and look at, who can ask questions, how long the questions can be, how President Trump's attorneys can respond. So it's just a little bit more of like a turn-by-turn direction if we actually want to get to articles of impeachment.
But also making a show of, hey, we're not backing down from this. We may have been away and off your TV screens for the last few bits, the whole summer, in fact. But here we are back in action again.
Making a show of that, and frankly, in doing so, making a show of the rift between Democrats on this issue, where Jerry Nadler of the Judiciary Committee, I think, feels that he has to go forward, that they, again, are proposing these new investigatory procedures. And then you have Speaker Nancy Pelosi essentially saying, I just want everyone to know this is not formal impeachment proceeding. So it's showing everyone we're here, we're doing something, but it's also highlighting the division in the Democratic Party.
Okay, well, speaking of the House Democrats taking on President Trump, the president's legal team on Friday asked a federal judge to dismiss a lawsuit from the Democrats over unsealing his tax returns. And what did he argue?
This is actually a pretty stunning argument, and I feel like I'm kind of outside the realm of being stunned anymore. But what happened is the House committee asked for President Trump's tax returns. There's a 1924 law. It's not often used. It allows this committee to basically get anybody's tax returns. And they were like, Mr. President, you fall within the anybody definition. We'd like your tax returns. Now, President Trump said no, and therefore he was refusing to comply with a subpoena. The House went to federal court and said, we issued the subpoena. The president, the leader of the executive branch, is saying he won't comply. Federal judge, please order him to comply. And President Trump had a number of responses, but the one that people have really focused on is this idea that the House has no authority to enforce its own subpoenas.
And who would have that authority?
So what they're saying is, based on the separation of powers, that it is for the White House and Congress to come to a mutual decision about what is going to happen in terms of complying with these subpoenas. But this really is an incredibly significant statement. The idea that the House has no authority to go to federal court to enforce its own subpoenas. It's part of what we've seen for a long time, which is the broadening of executive power, the decrease in power by the other branches, the legislative branch and the judicial branch.
Well, then how could any legislative branch or entity exercise its oversight responsibility if it's not allowed to subpoena documents?
Well, that is the logical consequence of this argument. Now, it's possible that the Trump administration will try and say, no, we're actually just talking about this particular subpoena, because one of the arguments they've made is that under the 1924 statute allowing them to ask for tax returns, that there's no enforcement mechanism, that it doesn't spell out what happens if somebody refuses. So it's possible that we could either say now or in subsequent administrations, well, that argument's just confined to this particular law.
Okay, finally, it appears the Air Force has been staying at Donald Trump's resort in Scotland, not just once, apparently, but many times. We talked about this last week with Vice President Mike Pence's trip to Doonbeg in Ireland and staying at Trump's resort there. So what's happening with this? Is it different from this Pence trip, or is it all part of the same confusion of private and public money?
Well, I think that it's similar in the sense that it raises the same question we talked about last week, which is the Constitution has this domestic emoluments clause. And if you boil it down to its essence, what it's really saying is the president gets a salary from the federal government, but shouldn't get any more money from either the federal government or from states. Now, if the military is using Trump properties, and therefore money is going into these businesses, President Trump, unlike other presidents, has not divested of those businesses, then money is going into his pocket, and that money is coming from the federal government. So it does raise real domestic emoluments clause violation issues. It's also different when it comes to misusing the military and whether or not the military, frankly, is adhering to their guidelines. What we've seen from the military reporting is that they think they've followed the guidelines, but maybe they weren't aware enough of the appearance. So there's going to be investigation by the Air Force and, again, by a House committee.
Mm-hmm. Well, the Defense Department's saying, well, look, we put the crew up at this resort this time. There were no other nearby rooms available. It fit within the budget.
Yeah, there are a lot of explanations. And in this case, there's also a lot of facts that indicate, well, why are you, for instance, staying at this Trump resort, which was it's close to a airport, which has an agreement with the Trump resort and has a strong connection dating back to, I think, 2014. Why is there this sudden, since the Trump administration, uptick in the number of times the military have used that airport in order to stop and refuel? The Trump property is largely dependent on the success of the airport. And again, there's been this dramatic increase in U.S. military use of it. Typically, the U.S. military will use another military base, will not refuel at these private airport or, excuse me, other airports. Mm-hmm. And so at the very least, I would say it merits an investigation.
And at the very least, it raises some serious questions.
It raises the questions we've been talking about since day one, which is, are you using the presidency to privately profit?
Jessica Levinson, law professor at Loyola Law School and our regular Monday Legal Eagle. Thanks for stopping in.
Thank you.
Coming up, considered a big threat to Joe Biden after the first debate, Kamala Harris has slid in the polls. What happened? That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. California Democratic Senator and 2020 presidential hopeful Kamala Harris unveiled a sweeping criminal justice reform plan today. She wants to end the war on drugs. She wants to end the death penalty, solitary confinement, mass incarceration. She wants to phase out for-profit prisons, and she wants to legalize weed. It is a lot more progressive than her record as a prosecutor and as California's attorney general. Harris has acknowledged that. But will it light a fire under her bid for the White House as she lingers in the polls? She's way behind Joe Biden, Bernie Sanders, and Elizabeth Warren. Sahil Kapoor joins us now. He's a national political reporter for Bloomberg, and he was out on the campaign trail in New Hampshire this weekend covering Harris and some of the other candidates. Hi there.
Hi, good to talk to you.
Good to talk to you. So why is she rolling this out today?
Well, it's been a long time coming. This has been a part of a campaign that has been a struggle and something that she has tried to turn into a positive. I've talked to voters in the Democratic Party who say her prosecutor past makes them unlikely to vote for her. And there are others who look at that and say it's a positive because they believe it makes her effective, you know, at questioning President Trump's nominees like Brett Kavanaugh and Attorney General William Barr. So it's a double-edged sword. She's put this plan out, and I think you ran through the major components of it, and whether it lights a fire under her presidential bid remains to be seen.
Well, what is she doing in terms of positioning herself? Because as I indicated, this is a lot more liberal than her past positions have been on criminal justice. So is she trying to position herself to, you know, in the Warren Sanders wing of the party now firmly? She's planting her flag there?
That's a bit of a question mark. So this is another part of her campaign that she has struggled with, and that I found when I was reporting a piece recently about why she had kind of stagnated over the summer, didn't see the boost that many expected of her. One of the questions that Democratic voters have is, who is she? Where is she coming from? What are the convictions that are driving her campaign? And her three main rivals don't have that problem. Everyone knows Joe Biden is a moderate and an institutionalist, been in Washington for a long time. Everyone knows Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren represent front, the very progressive wing of the Democratic Party. And Kamala Harris is a little bit of both. She has taken some positions that come off as more progressive, more revolutionary, such as the Green New Deal. She has taken other positions and offered other pieces of rhetoric, such as I don't want to restructure America, that make her sound a little bit more pragmatic and incrementalist. So I don't think Democratic voters have a very clear handle on who she is and what's driving her.
Right. What about health care? She's gone back and forth on that, whether she believes in Medicare for all or not.
And this has played into the question that voters have about what's driving her and where she's coming from. She had originally co-sponsored the single-payer Medicare for All legislation by Bernie Sanders that would replace all private insurance with essentially put everyone in the Medicare program. And after getting a lot of questions about the elimination of private insurance that she expressed discomfort with, Harris backed off that plan, released one of her own that she also calls Medicare for All, but that maintains a private option for people who want to stay, who want to be covered by a private insurer. And instead of easing those concerns, instead of making her more palatable to the skeptics of Medicare for All, it kind of drew fire from all sides, with people asking her why is she doing this and wondering whether there was some opportunism in that switch.
What about that moment after the first debate, or during the first debate, when she went after Vice President Joe Biden, and she was widely praised for that as being having a real breakout moment during that debate? But then I guess she tried to do the same thing in the second debate and it didn't work.
That was an extraordinary moment in the first debate when Kamala Harris turned to Vice President Biden, confronted him, delivered a series of punches that became the highlight of the debate. We're talked about for a long time, and we saw a major boost in the standing of Kamala Harris. She jumped to as high as second place in a number of Democratic polls at the time, but she has since fallen back to around where she was at the beginning of summer, about 7%. And yes, she tried to replicate that in the second debate. She tried to go after Biden again, but it didn't work as well. And one of the theories I've heard for that is, in the first debate, she came off as feisty and interesting and made Democrats want to give her a look. But in the second debate, people perceived that as too negative, that she turned to Biden multiple times and went after him. And one theory I've heard about that from some prominent Democrats is that it looked like there were several Democrats on stage, not just her, who were trying to create a circular firing squad rather than focusing on the goal of defeating President Trump.
Hmm. Well, so she kind of acknowledges that she's had a problem in this internal document that was leaked over the weekend, I think, to Politico. It's called the summer. They're calling it a summer slump document. What's in that? And what are her own acknowledgments as to why she's not doing as well as she thought she might?
So I was in New Hampshire with her and a bunch of other Democratic candidates who took questions from reporters, and she talked about how she doesn't view the polls as predictive at this point. She talked about her previous races, including San Francisco DA and California Attorney General, where the polls looked bad for her at first, and that she eventually won. So I think it seems like she is disengaging her campaign from addressing and talking about these polls, from like playing the game of the horse race and the process, which she kind of did do after the first debate when it suited her. So I think it's just more of a step back from her campaign and say, we're playing the long game. We shouldn't overinterpret the polls. We shouldn't get too high when they look good. We shouldn't get too low when they look bad. And we should keep our eyes on the prize.
Well, don't you always say that when you're down in the polls?
Precisely.
Yeah, you like to trumpet the polls
the
when you're
is whether they
top.
Maintain. Exactly. The question is whether they maintain this and whether, whether the campaign takes on a different posture, a different outlook when the polls are good as well as when they're bad. You can't simply trumpet them when they look good and dismiss them when they don't.
Right. Now, you've drawn a comparison to Marco Rubio, whose 2016 bid really didn't take off despite high expectations. I mean, he made it a long way, but obviously didn't make it to the end. So explain what you mean by this comparison.
Sure. Well, it was actually Marco Rubio's communications director from 2016 who said he sees some similarities between the way Rubio ran then and the way Kamala Harris is running now. And as I see it, there's a fork in the road for Kamala Harris at the moment. She could go down potentially if things don't look up for her the path of Rubio, where, you know, you have ideological credentials, where the base of the party kind of likes you and is intrigued by you. The establishment of the party views you as a fresh face, a formidable candidate, a generational candidate who could do well for the party, but that not enough voters view you as a first choice. Right. If you're acceptable by all, you're not necessarily loved by enough people, is the way Rubio's former aide put it to me. So that's the negative path that you could go down if things don't go well. The positive, of course, is the Barack Obama arc from 2008. He was also struggling at this point. He did not immediately catch fire. He was not very good on the stump at first, but he got better at it. He consistently improved throughout, the year of 2007, and was able to make it connect in the primaries of 2008 when it mattered. So there's still a possibility that Kamala Harris could translate the energy of a campaign on the ground.
So what do you expect her to do in the debate this week?
That's a good question, and I don't know the answer to that. I suspect it won't be another a repeat of what she tried to do in the second debate, which was to focus most of her energy on Biden. I think her campaign is recognizing that it needs to offer a clear definition, a clear sense of who she is, a core pitch, if you will. Right. If you ask Democratic voters right now, who is Kamala Harris and what does she stand for? A lot of them won't have a clear sense of that. So I think she's going to use this debate to try to refine that, to try to set herself apart and to offer an elevator pitch that people can, you know, when they think of her, they can know this is who she is and this is what she's all about.
Sahil Kapoor, national political reporter for Bloomberg. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, guess what? It is Monday, and it's week two of our UnDrive. And so if you haven't done it already, now is a chance to do it, to become a member or renew your membership at kcrw.com/join or 800-600-5279. And we have a fantastic incentive for you. You can be automatically entered to win the all-new iPad Air plus an Apple Pencil. But you need to do it today because the special sweepstakes ends tomorrow. Join, renew, or upgrade your membership today. Lots of great thank you gifts, such as a New York Times or an LA Times membership, or both for $32 a month. Why not both? 800-600-5279, kcrw.com/join. And thank you. Coming up, the indie band Yacht turns to AI to create their latest album by mining all their previous music.
The way that machine learning works, the way AI works, is that you have to train algorithms by giving those algorithms huge amounts of data, historical musical data in our context.
Yacht's big experiment next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. For our Monday music segment today, we are looking at songs written by robots. Indie rock band Yacht fed their entire back catalog, 82 songs from the last 17 years, into a series of machines that analyzed their lyrics and melodies and then created songs for them. Well, this fully automated songwriting process is the creative force behind their new 10-song album called Chain Tripping. And here to tell us more about their new album is Yacht. John Bechtold, Claire
Hi.
Evans, Rob Key Sweater.
Hello.
Hi, you guys.
Hi, thanks for having us.
Well, thanks for coming in. All right, so tell us about how you came up with this idea.
One, we wanted to understand it. We live in a world where we're completely surrounded by, semi-autonomous intelligent entities, and they are embedded in everything materially and digitally all around us. And so as artists, we're interested in making art about the real world that we live in. Two, because we felt like there was this really interesting opportunity to understand more about ourselves, because the way that machine learning works, the way the AI works, is that you have to train algorithms by giving those algorithms huge amounts of data, historical musical data in our context. And by doing that, you have this opportunity to dive deep into the sort of ambiguous mathematical space of the history of music, of your own music, of your own influences, of our own back catalog.
So is it kind of like reverse Spotify or reverse Pandora?
No, it's nothing like that at all.
Okay.
I like that. That's a great
I wish it was like that. When we first started thinking about making this album in this way, that's what we thought. We thought that, yeah, we'd be working with raw audio. But no, it's just we're working with sheet music, with MIDI, with symbolic data. So nothing to do with the actual sound of the records, but just the actual writing, the composition of the album.
I see. So they weren't actually listening and creating similar songs.
No.
They were reading. They.
Yes.
They. I need to anthropomorphize. Yeah.
It's so hard to talk about without using those words.
I know. Well, Siri is, Siri and Alexa are people.
They are people.
But are they?
Yes, they're made of people.
They have a bunch of canned responses. They're not really thinking.
Well, I like to think of them as people.
Yeah, I like to think of them. I treat them with respect. I say please when I ask Siri for something. So.
But yeah, we definitely thought that we could just give, a Siri type entity our entire back catalog and say, write us new songs. And we thought that the art would be about committing to whatever, the Siri type entity spat out. But of course, we're not there, because if, an algorithm could write a pop song, the airwaves would be full of algorithmically generated pop songs, I guarantee it. It's actually much more complicated than that. And we had to sort of intervene as humans in the loop many, many times during the process in order to make something that was actually listenable and actually sounded like us.
Okay, well, let's hear one of those listenable songs. It's called Downtown Dancing.
Welcome to your pleasure. Just don't make the sound. I'm in doubt. I'm laughing. I'm making a punch. Lucky me. I'm leaving. Make my party.
Okay, so all of those lyrics were written by the AI.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so when you heard "Welcome to Your Pleasure, Just Don't Make a Sound,"
we were like, ching, 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 we're rich. This is great.
No,
our lyric generating algorithm model was co-created with an artist here in LA called Ross Goodwin, who's like a hacker gonzo poet guy. And we worked together to build this corpus of 2 million and change words. Words from our own lyrical back catalog, words from bands that we love, lyrics from music we grew up listening to, just everything that goes into the stew of making a song in the normal way. And then we trained this algorithm on that. So the algorithm was kind of pulling from our own influences, and it learned language from lyrics that we gave it. So what we worked with in the studio was this massive document, like thousands and thousands of words, hundreds of pages of just cool, weird lyrics that this thing had generated. And then we manually went through and highlighted the things that we liked and culled them sort of cut up style, if you will, like a William Burroughs approach.
Like a Dada-esque poem.
Yes,
exactly.
And that's why the lyrics sound the way they do.
And so what about the music part?
Yeah, we did a similar process where we transcribed our back catalog, all of our songs, fed them into this algorithm, and what it generated was, again, like a giant corpus of MIDI data that we then went through and assigned to different instruments or vocal melodies or drum patterns. And so we had to make some choices about what made the song the song.
And it was only just pieces, too. It couldn't write an entire song. It could only write riffs and short bursts of melodic information. And so then we took that information and had to learn how to play it on guitar or play it on drums or keyboard, which was at times super frustrating and difficult.
Yeah, because these systems, like, they don't have bodies, They don't know what it is to have a body. So they're not writing melodies that are easy or natural to play on any given instrument. They're just spitting out sequences of note data. Whether or not that's, like, takes a virtuosic, guitar player to actually play in real life is up to us to determine, So
Much of it did you alter versus...
None.
Yeah, we decided we were going to be very strict about how we used this material. And we created a set of rules that were, we can't add anything, we can't improvise anything, we can't harmonize
or jam in any way.
We decided it would be just a subtractive process. So we could remove things, like we could take out a word, but we couldn't add a word for the lyrics. Same with the drum patterns and the melodies.
Okay, let's hear another one. This one's called Scatterhead.
Drop so heavy in a tiny scene. I feel like I'm dying. Living in pieces. Like a million people. I was born to lose control. Mr. Adam possessed.
Well, you kind of sound like robots there.
Yeah, that's just how I sing, though. Yeah.
But there's a little Kraftwerk-y element in this, yeah?
Yeah,
thank
sure.
you. Yeah, we could be so lucky for that comparison.
That data is in there somewhere, you know? The lyrics algorithm has definitely got some Kraftwerk in the DNA somewhere.
Yeah.
So, but it, and there is a hook. Does the computer, the algorithm, the robot, whatever you want to call it, does it hook onto the hooks?
No, it doesn't even know that it's doing language, you know? It's just generating like words character by character.
So and letter by letter.
Yeah, letter by letter. So it's, you give it an A and then it's guessing what the most likely next letter is going to be based on everything it's learned about language from only song lyrics, for example. So, you know, when it spits out an interesting idiom or a weird phrase, it's truly like a lightning bolt of just something magic happening in the machine somewhere.
Like in the course of that song, there's a phrase that we loved when the first time we read it, and it's palm of your eye. What does that mean? What does that make you think of? Palm of your eye.
Wow, she's really thinking about it.
I am actually thinking about it.
Yeah. It's
well,
nice. I like it.
I'm thinking
it.
That you can read your lifeline and... Mm.
Yeah.
In the future when you do palm reading.
There's something really beautiful about this material because it forces you to project meaning onto something that doesn't have meaning coming from it, you know? So it sort of repositions you as a writer. It makes you look at your own music from the outside and try to like put meaning on top of it rather than have it emerge from, which is like just an interesting position to be in as an artist. And it's kind of similar to the position that the listener is normally in, right?
Yeah.
I mean, people who listen to pop songs and they're just guessing what the songs are about. They're projecting their own experiences on songs that are about really general things like love and life and death and sadness. And sometimes pop music, the more opaque it is, the more universal it is because everyone can bring their own thing to it. This music is kind of like a meta version of that where nobody knows what's going on and we're all in it together, which feels kind of democratizing and beautiful to me.
Or totally alienating.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah.
And meaningless.
Well, I guess...
And nihilistic. Anyway,
wow,
Monday.
You went the dark way.
Happy
okay.
Monday.
Yeah, sure.
Okay, let's hear one more song. This one's called Blue on Blue. Computer likes a blue-eyed boy.
Mm-hmm. Apparently.
Yeah.
Not a brown-eyed, handsome man.
Yeah, something like that. I mean, who knows what the computer likes? It's fun to try to guess. But ultimately, it's about what we like.
Well, would you do this again?
Well, it's interesting because, yeah, we started working on this 3 years ago. And since then, all of the technologies that we used have advanced in crazy ways. So we first started having to ask people for help and using command line tools with text windows. Then it evolved to like an online spreadsheet, and now there's plugins in recording software that you can use.
Yeah, I mean, by the time we sit down and make another record, who knows where we'll be in terms of, you know, how accessible these tools will be and how radically improved these tools will be. But I think we will. I honestly think we will. I think this record is really pure. I mean, we made all these rules and we were really specific about only using generated material. I think if we come back to it, we'll sort of know our position within this collaboration and we'll have a little bit more freedom in terms of what we contribute as humans.
Yeah, but we'll always be on a path of interrogating whatever new technology is out there.
Okay, so there was this controversy that happened a few years ago with the sex tape, the fake sex tape.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess people felt exploited and cheated by the whole thing. And you guys, I guess, learned a valuable lesson or whatever. I don't know. How did you feel about how that whole thing
out? Awful. Terrible. Yeah.
I will say that in the aftermath of a failed piece of subversive internet art, we found ourselves really wanting to reinterrogate who we were, what our values were, and what we could contribute to this world. We kind of went in dormant for a long time. I wrote a book. We did a lot of thinking. We, I think, approached this whole AI project as an opportunity to look deeper into ourselves and see what it really meant to challenge technology in a way that wasn't cynical and like trolly, which I think was where we had ended up being before.
Mm.
And it feels, you know, I think we've come out the other end humbled and excited to be involved in another conversation.
Yeah. So, but it's interesting that is the whole technology aspect is something that you're interested in. And on the one hand, as you say, it could be cynical and trolly and exploitative, which I guess it was with that.
Yes.
And on the other hand, it could be something adventuresome and exploratory and positive, which
I think
is what this is.
Yeah, that's the hope. I think it's very easy to become very cynical about technology in this day and age. And I think when we did the sex tape project, we were sort of trying to make commentary about the internet while we were still so deep. We were too deep inside of it, you know. We were sort of clawing our way out of the paper bag rather than stepping out of the bag entirely and reevaluating what it even means to make art in the 21st century, yeah. Which is what we're trying to do now.
Yeah, and then the Me Too thing came along after that, and so yeah. That put it all in another perspective.
Yeah, I mean, it's also really interesting looking back on it now because, you know, the conversation has really changed.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I mean, I think everybody I don't want anyone to go through what we went through in terms of being on the bad side of an internet scandal, but it is a very humbling experience, and it does teach you a lot about what the internet is to go through the eye of the storm and out the other end. You can really see you can see it all really clearly. It's changed our relationship to the internet completely and changed the way that we sort of talk about things and talk about ourselves. I think twice about everything I say, and it's a good thing.
Yeah. Has it changed your relationship with your audience?
Hard to say. I think our fans have always been there and always will be. I think our fans kind of understood what we were trying to do and sort of, I wouldn't say they all gave us a pass, but I think people were willing to have the conversation with us and mm-hmm. were willing to hear us out. As far as the rest of the world, giant question mark. How can any of us know?
Well, you're back. Anyway, you're here, so we'll see what the reaction is to
this
new album.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, thank you for having us.
Well, it's great to have you. Thanks for coming by.
Thanks so much.
That's Yacht, Claire Evans, Jonna Bechtolt, and Rob Keysweater. The new album is called Chain Tripping. It's out now. Welcome to your pleasure. Just don't make And Jared Hill is here now for a preview of Greater LA coming up at 1 o'clock. Hi.
I never know what music to expect when I come to talk to you.
I know, it's all a new thing.
Yes. So I'm excited. So today, I live in Inglewood, and today I'm taking you to Inglewood. We're going to be talking about...
To your house?
Not exactly to my house, because I don't know you that well just yet. But we're going to talk about the gentrification happening in Inglewood and what does that look like.
Oh, it's massive.
Yeah. So Anna Scott
has... Stadium and all that.
Yeah, yeah. Anna Scott's been doing some really great reporting on that. Then we're going to talk about Black Banks and how that impacts people being able to buy their homes, kind of related to Inglewood. And then Westminster, 5 members of their city council are up for a recall, and it's pretty wild. For a recall, yes. So it's kind of a Real Housewives of Westminster City Council down there. It's a wild drama.
Excellent. Coming up at 1 o'clock, Jared Hill. Thank you.
Yeah.
Don't forget, 800-600-5279. It's the End Drive. Call that number. Go to kcrb.com/join to become a member.
That's right. We're giving away that cool iPad and
the pencil.
I'm jealous. Yeah.
I just want the pencil.
I should go upgrade my membership. Maybe I'll be entered to win.
No.
That's not how that works.
No. Okay. Sorry. Okay. Coming up, when humans introduced tiny shrimp into Lake Tahoe to feed the trout, they had no idea these shrimp would become tiny monsters. That story next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. The famed crystal clear waters of Lake Tahoe are becoming a lot less clear. There are lots of suspects: algae, runoff, fertilizer, erosion. The latest, tiny invasive shrimp. But in a turning lemons into lemonade moment, some researchers are proposing the shrimp be harvested and turned into a health supplement. Louis Sahagan wrote about this for the LA Times. Welcome back.
Hi there. Thank you.
Well, let's talk about what kind of shrimp this is. This is a teensy tiny shrimp. How big is it?
These are dime-sized shrimp. They're known as mysis shrimp, M-Y-S-I-S. And they were introduced into the lake in the early 1960s to fatten up trout for anglers during that period of great development at the lake. So what happened, though, is that the shrimp and the trout never crossed paths. The shrimp did not evolve in the lake, and the trout didn't evolve with them there or elsewhere. So the shrimp, what no one knew, in the day, they drifted down to the very bottom of this incredibly deep lake. And at night, they drifted up to the surface to eat the kind of zooplankton that the trout love most, native zooplankton.
So they were actually taking food away from the trout, not fattening them up.
Taking food away from the trout. So what happened? The trout got smaller, and these shrimp were eating their favorite food, which led to the diminishing quality of the water.
Well, so what are these tiny shrimp doing to make the water so cloudy?
The shrimp are eating native zooplankton that normally eat particles, including a kind of algae that can cloud the waters. So the shrimp proliferated in the lake by eating the native zooplankton, which eat particles. So without the native zooplankton, these scientists are now theorizing, the water has been getting dingier. Answer, get rid of the shrimp. Their solution, an armada of trawlers that would ply the lake at night, in the dark of night, when the shrimp are up near the surface.
And why do scientists think that this is the culprit rather than the usual suspects, pollution, erosion, things like that?
This is a cause of a lot of hand-wringing right now, because previous findings from that same laboratory, which was established in 1959, over the decades, its previous findings led to more and more restrictions against building to prevent runoff, wetlands restoration projects. More than $2 billion have been spent in the understanding that it was development from runoff and algae triggered by global warming that was the cause. So, you know, there is a lot of concern in particular because this announcement by this UC Davis Research Laboratory has not been peer-reviewed. So it was not peer-reviewed before they announced, gee whiz, we think we found out what the real problem is, and we also know what to do about it.
Okay, let's talk about the harvesting now. How would they harvest omega-3s out of these little shrimp?
They are in discussions now, the scientists told me, with a manufacturer who is telling them that with enough of these shrimp he has, or the company could extract the omega-3 from, you know, thousands of tons of these shrimp and then put them out to market in capsule form.
Huh. And people are saying that that's a good idea?
Actually, people don't know what to think. And even critics are that I talk to, some of them are worried about being too harsh in public. Why? Because these scientists might be onto something. And if they're onto something, if this pans out, well, you know, no one wants to be on the wrong side of that situation. And so, however, some leading scientists, including the man regarded as the leading researcher at Lake Tahoe since 1958, Charles Goldman himself, he is saying in public, and he told me, gee whiz, I wish they wouldn't have announced this before their theory was critiqued by way of a formal scientific study.
Well, they're going to go ahead and do it anyway, right?
They are going ahead with talking to a manufacturer of omega-3. They're going ahead with analyses of how many trawlers would be needed to put a real dent in the population of shrimp that now inhabits one end of this 22-mile-long, 12-mile-wide, 1,655-feet-deep lake with 39 trillion gallons of water in it. They are moving ahead with a proposal, yes, for a fleet of trawlers. What would the cost be? Who would build them? Who would they buy them from? What the market might be for omega-3? They're moving ahead with all of that, which worries, as I say, people who are thinking, wow, shouldn't you have had these findings substantiated before making such a damn near, you know, historic announcement?
Louis Sahagan, always good to talk with you.
Well, thank you so much.
About matters great and small. That's the LA Times' Louis Sahagan. All right, Michelle, how are you?
I'm well. I enjoyed learning all about the little Loch Ness monsters that are...
Oh, they're menaces.
...swimming around Lake Tahoe.
Tiny menaces.
Tiny, tiny menaces that are rich in omega-3s. Well, so not totally menaces, just a menace in a different form. Anyway, got some feedback from our yacht segment about all the digital music they're creating. Alan Smithy says, I absolutely love all of these computer-generated songs. I want to forward this to a friend who's a gamer. I think he'll absolutely lose it because it sounds like the weird video game music he is into.
Okay. Which is probably one of the intents
right.
of it.
Yeah.
To sound as artificial as possible.
Yeah, exactly. Well, when you're feeding everything into a
machine.
Computer. Yeah. I mean, I'm not a musician personally, so I don't know how any of that works. But yeah, that must be the intent.
Right. You know, to humanize the machine.
Yeah.
Are we all doing that?
Right.
Speaking of... We want you to go to your machine and become a member or renew your membership to KCRW. You can do that by going online at kcrw.com/join. It's our UnDrive, and we really need to hear from you. It's our second week, and, well, we're kind of in the middle of it. This is time for you to decide to do what you need to do to support us, because we cannot do it without you. You can be entered to win a new Apple Air, the iPad Air, plus the Apple Pencil if you join or renew your membership today, but you got to be in it. KCRW.com/join. Support your public radio station. I'll see you tomorrow.